Welcome today to an interview series with Outstanding Professional. I'm Stephen Abraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with the celebrated and distinguished scientists, Dr. Francine Berman, Dr. Justine Cassell, and Dr. Tracy Camp. These outstanding researchers and educators will talk about their recent tour of China, speaking about emerging technologies in computing. You all have a considerable history of outstanding contributions in a number of fields. Thank you for sharing your considerable expertise, deep accumulated insights, and wisdom with our audience.
Thanks for inviting us. Happy to be here.
Yeah, thank you, Stephen.
Well, you know, you have these fascinating backgrounds, so can you each introduce yourself in your current roles?
This is Tracy Camp. I'll go first. I am a professor of computer science at the Colorado School of Mines. I lead a research group on ad hoc networks. These are networks that form on the fly. I am also an ACM Distinguished Speaker and helped organize this tour that we did in China. But of course, my most important role right now is the role of wife and mother. I have two young children.
This is Fran. I'm director of the San Diego Supercomputer Center, and I'm also a professor in the Computer Science and Engineering Department and High Performance Computing Endowed Chair at UC San Diego. I'm also in transition. In August, I'll leave SDSC, and I'll be joining Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute as the Vice President of Research. I'm also an ACM Fellow.
This is Justine Cassell. I'm the Director of the Center for Technology and Social Behavior at Northwestern University. I'm also the AT&T Chair and Professor of Electrical Engineering and Computer Science and of Communication Studies, also at Northwestern University.
You are amazing role models to our audience because of the tremendous histories that each one of you have. So if you can sort of describe them, what triggered your interest in computing and which one decision do you consider your most important in your career and which one decision led to your greatest lesson, growth, or challenge?
Well, this is Justine. I'll go first. I often like to say that I have been ensciencedover the course of my career. That is, unlike many computer scientists, I did not start out in math or computer science. I was actually a humanities major in college, and I got an undergraduate degree in comparative literature. I was a social science graduate student. My PhD is in linguistics and psychology. And it wasn't until I was a young professor that I began working in computing. The decision that led to that switch and that has been the most important in my career to date was to look for ways to use computer science to verify theories in the social sciences. Since I was working on human face-to-face communication in those days, I decided to build some kind of virtual human that could communicate with both language and nonverbal behavior. It turned out that nobody had ever done that before. I got an NSF grant to spend a year at the University of Pennsylvania, and I was lucky enough to actually be able to implement that first virtual human with a fabulous team of faculty and graduate students at UPenn, and that got me hooked. I switched fields, and I never looked back. That decision also led to my greatest challenge and my greatest growth. I ended up moving to the MIT Media Lab, where I stayed for 9 years and got tenure in 2001. And so I had to learn about computer science and the culture of computer scientists as I went.
So this is Fran. I think that my story is similar to Justine's in the sense that possibly the most influential change was also from math to computer science for me, so a change in field. I was one of those kids, probably like many of your listeners, who just loved puzzles and thinking about analytical kinds of things when I was a kid. And so I went through the math route and just was unbelievably compelled by math. You know, teachers talking about Mobius strips and the fact that there was more than one kind of infinity and those kinds of things really intrigued me as a kid. I was a math major in college and also in graduate school, but then also evolved to computer science through the theory, and so my first positions were in theoretical computer science. Over my career, my work became increasingly applied. I got interested in parallel processing and then grid computing and now data cyber infrastructure, and it's been a great ride, and I think it's probably like a lot of your listeners, so you really evolve through many different fields, through your own studies and your own interests. For me, I think my greatest growth has been when I have jumped positions. And it was a tremendous challenge and a great opportunity to become SDSC director from running a lab in the CSE department. And I grew and really changed in wonderful ways through that transition. And I'm looking forward to the next transition to VP of Research to bring on those kinds of really enlightening changes. So I'm really looking forward to that.
This is Tracy. I, like both Fran and Justine, have switched from my initial focus, which was I was also a math major, just like Fran. And I think my interest in computing evolved because of how I am completely in awe of just anything that is logical. And computer science is a very logical field, and my brain works in a very logical manner. We even raise our children with the theory of love and logic. Not sure if your listeners have heard of that, but that is how we raise our kids, and it makes sense to us because my husband and I are both extremely logical. I'd like to address your question of what one decision do you consider most important in your career? And I think that when I look back on my life and my career, the decision that to me turned out to be a very important decision was the decision to switch research fields. When I had initially graduated with my PhD, I tried to extend my PhD work and get funded for the work that I had done on my PhD with looking at various ways I could extend that work, remaining within that field that I earned my PhD in. And I didn't have a lot of passion. I think I was burned out on that particular field. And looking back, it's now not surprising to me that with my lack of passion, I also had very little success in the field. But I was very nervous about switching research fields pre-tenure because it's an enormous undertaking to change research fields, but I decided to do that and jumped into a field that I knew very, very little about, but that excited me to no end, and I almost instantly started having tremendous success in that field. And I think that one decision was a tremendous opportunity for growth as well as challenge in the research venue.
Well, thank you for sharing all of those insights. I mean, it's just of great value to our audience. So based upon your experiences now and the kind of shifting here, what can major IT societies do to foster global collaboration?
Oh, this is Fran. What we found, I think, going to China was that these face-to-face interactions were just invaluable. I think that science is a global community, and we all interact with colleagues all over the world all the time remotely, but really nothing beats getting to sit down next to someone and form a relationship and start talking about a variety of, you know, technical and non-technical activities, sharing a meal together, et cetera. And I think the professional societies can really foster those kinds of interactions between researchers. We certainly found that when we were in China that we spent a lot of time with colleagues over meals and, you know, in discussions and stuff like that. And it was really important, I think, in solidifying and forming those relationships.
So any other additional comments?
I think, this is Tracy, I think Fran really hit that one on the head. Having that interaction with the Chinese researchers that are over there was tremendously beneficial. Our world is getting smaller and smaller, and so meeting at these conferences or spending time in each other's country is definitely, I think, the way to go to foster these global collaborations.
Well, you recently did a speaking tour of China, and speaking of China, and this kind of a natural segue, can you each profile your speaking topic areas?
So this is Tracy again. I suggest that we go in order of our presentations while we were in China, so I'll go ahead and go first. My topic is in a field that I do research in, which is on wireless sensor networks. A wireless sensor is a tiny device that has the ability to monitor our physical world in some manner, whether the sensor is monitoring temperature or humidity or movement or pressure or soil makeup. There are lots of different ways that a sensing device can monitor our world. And these wireless sensor devices, in addition to being able to sense something within our world, they can also do some computation and store some information, as well as communicate with other sensing devices, assuming that this particular device has a radio, some type of communication facility on it. So if you think about these sensing devices that can sense something in the world, do some computation, store some information, and communicate with other sensing devices, then you can imagine what you might be able to do if you take 100 of these sensing devices, or even 1,000 of them, and spread them across something within our world, whether it's a forest or a bridge or a home or a body. And you can think about then, what can you do with this? And the answer to that question is that you can do a lot of things. Wireless sensor networks, a whole network of these sensing devices, can improve our world in numerous ways, from environmental monitoring to inventory tracking to some type of health applications. The number of applications is tremendous. And what these networks do is they provide us with a very rich understanding of our environment and the ability to control our surroundings in some manner. So that's the field that I work on, is within these wireless sensor networks. There are many technological hurdles that need to be solved in order to reach this future that we're heading towards of having the sensing devices throughout our world. For example, these individual sensing devices are incredibly resource constrained. While they can compute, they have limited processing power. While they can store information, they have limited storage capacity. While they can communicate, they have very limited communication bandwidth. There are several open research questions in this field that require innovative solutions in order to reach having wireless sensor networks pervade our world. So that's the research that I do, and that's what I spoke about during our tour in China.
Well, I went next in the order when we talked, and I talked about the deluge of digital data. This is a pretty exciting world, and I think data is an integral part of this, of our modern world. If we think about the digital data in the form of documents, text, video, audio, you know, et cetera, we're just surrounded by it. And in fact, in 2007, statistics say that we actually passed the time when we're creating more digital data than we have storage to be able to retain it. So this is a real problem for our modern world. And one of the things that I talked about was how we might strategically approach managing, preserving, manipulating, mining, et cetera, our fragile digital data. And one of the points that I wanted to make during my talk is that digital data really serves as what you might think of as just fundamental infrastructure in the information age, just like our lights are fundamental physical infrastructure that we use all the time and ignore until something goes wrong. Well, our digital data really is the same thing in the cyber world. And so during my talk, I talked about the challenges of accessing it, managing it, mining it, et cetera. And the solutions are really holistic. They require technical aspects, but there's also social aspects, regulatory aspects, economic aspects, et cetera. So I dealt with most of those kinds of things during my talk.
And this is Justine speaking. I spoke about virtual humans and the range of computer science fields represented in the task of implementing a virtual human. It's an interesting area in part because it has the ability to push researchers to make strides in a number of different fields, in fields as diverse as artificial intelligence, computer graphics, natural language processing, And of course, virtual humans play a major role in the entertainment industry today, such as non-player characters in video games, avatars in Second Life. They play a role in commerce, such as online guides to commerce sites. And we're beginning to see them in real-world venues as well, such as virtual museum guides. And all of these are examples of virtual humans. As far as challenges and innovations, these days many of us are working on virtual humans that no longer look like white male computer scientists. We're trying to build virtual humans that may be speaking different dialects of English, different languages altogether, that may look differently from one another and look differently from us, and asking the question of how we represent cultural diversity. How do we represent linguistic diversity? How do we deal with virtual humans that need to build a relationship with a real human as opposed to simply collaborate on a task? Another innovation is ensuring that these agents can live with humans over long periods of time, and that involves that building rapport and changing the relationship over time. And these are going to be important next steps because I believe that virtual humans, like humanoid robots, are going to be increasingly present in our world.
Now, it sounds like with all of the different kind of topics and your amazing research that the three of you are doing, that you have this opportunity to kind of meet each other and engage and share ideas. It must have been an exciting time just listening to each other.
It was really exciting. This is Justine speaking. I found myself thinking a lot about the sensors that Tracy talked about and how to use them, and she's going to find herself deluged with emails from my graduate students because I wrote home right away and told them about what she was doing. Some of our work is on what we call shared reality that requires implementing the world with very tiny sensors. So the chance to listen to one another was really one of the best parts of the trip for me.
This is Fran. I really agree with that. We had the great pleasure, at least I had the great pleasure, of listening to Justine and Tracy's talks three times, and every single time I got something out of it, and although we certainly didn't plan it this way, they all fit together in very interesting ways because you think about sensors and the amount of data they have and the way Justine uses it for her work, and they just all played together well. So it was really terrific, and of course offline we were able to ask each other all kinds of questions about the things we had spoke about. So really, I agree with that, and I think for me that was one of the highlights of the trip.
Yeah, I completely concur. A highlight was listening to their presentations and thinking about collaboration opportunities, and then a highlight also was just hanging with two, you know, fabulous, fabulous women. Yeah, we had quite a week, Stephen.
It also sounds like you could start a corporation between the three of you and get venture funding and become the new Google or something like that.
And we'll give you a cut if it ever happens, Stephen. It was your idea first.
You know, can you share your details now on the universities and cities that you visited?
Well, this is Justine. I can tell you that we visited three universities in three different cities, really all across China. We visited Tsinghua University in Beijing. We visited the Huazhong University of Science and Technology in Wuhan. And then in the very south of China, we visited the South China University of Science and Technology in Guangzhou.
Fran?
Well, each of them were terrific. And they all had really a different character. And we, of course, we enjoyed them all. Tsinghua was very cosmopolitan. It was in the middle of Beijing, and we just had a terrific time. When we went to Wuhan, I actually did an extra lecture for a colleague there that I had met in Italy, and I spent some time with his group and some of the folks that he works with. And when we went to Guangzhou, the students were tremendously curious, and they asked us all kinds of questions. And in fact, the university is on, I don't know how to describe it, kind of a high-tech island. And it was just extremely interesting. So all three of them had their own special characters, and people were tremendously welcoming wherever we went.
Yeah, and this is Tracy. I just also want to add that each of these universities are a major technological university in the region where they reside. The interesting thing was while we were in China, the ACM World Finals programming contest was ongoing. It actually finished while we were in China, and teams from all three of the universities that we visited competed in the World Finals. There were 7,000 teams that participated in the competition around the world, and then 100 of those teams from around the world qualified for the World Finals in Stockholm. And all three universities that we visited actually were within that 100 and qualified for the World Finals and then attended Stockholm. And then, in addition, competed extremely well and finished in the top 20 teams of the 100 that made it to the World Finals. So that was rather exciting because here we were meeting the computer science faculty and students at these three universities, and we got to celebrate a little bit with them of their achievement in the World Finals for the ACM programming contest. And it also just illustrates that all three of the universities we visited have extremely strong computer science programs in China.
I'm just curious about this ACM programming contest. Can you just provide a quick outline of what it entails and the degree of difficulty?
Fran or Justine, do you want to chat?
About the programming contest?
Yeah.
I'll let you do that.
Well, I've never had a team go all the way to the World Finals, Stephen. I've only participated on a team at a regional level, and I can just state that it's extremely intense. You have a team, and then you go to some university where all the teams reside, and then you're given these programming problems, and then your task is to solve as many of the programming problems as you can within some time limit. So it's an extremely intense type of competition, and you need all team members to really be hands-on and focused and working hard in order to make progress and do well. So I think that the fact that they all three of these universities competed against 7,000 teams and made it to the top 20, I just find that extremely impressive.
Again, you could start corporations from these individuals.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, these are top programmers who are able to take a problem, break it down, and solve it in a, quick and most likely elegant fashion.
So how would you characterize the makeup of your audiences, again, because of all the cities and that you visited, the universities that you visited, and just all the people that you interacted with?
So this is Tracy again. I'll go ahead and tackle this one first, or answer this one first. We had probably the least amount was 100 people in the audience, and probably the most was closer to about 150 or 170 attendees in the audience at each of our stops. And so there were several students and faculty that attended our presentations. Most of the attendees were from the university that we were visiting. These universities were the, very strong science and tech universities in the area, and so most of the attendees were from there. We do know that, though, that regional universities were invited as well. I do not know how many attendees there were from other universities, but I know other local faculty and students were invited. Within that group, most the attendees that were in the group, most of the attendees were students, and I think that they had interest in a very wide range of computer science topics. They all seem to be, very interested in listening to our very diverse research areas. And I think at least for me, the fact that most of the attendees were students was not a big surprise. I mean, these types of ACM Distinguished lectures are designed by ACM mainly for students to keep their interest in computing and show them what some other people are doing in the field. And for, I think, all three of us, I mean, we were thrilled to have so many students in the audience, so that wasn't too much of a surprise. But what was a little bit of a surprise for me anyways was how few of the attendees were actual ACM members. I think that about maybe half of the attendees had heard of ACM, but very few were actual members of ACM. And, you know, I know that there have been some ACM members from China have been members of ACM for a long, long time. But ACM just recently opened an office in China, and part of the reason for our tour was to highlight the opening of this office. So at each of these presentations, I actually gave about a 8 to 10 minute presentation on ACM and what ACM is and what they can do for the computer science professionals in China, and, of course, then giving them contact information for this new office that exists. And it is the office that has opened is at Tsinghua University in Beijing.
Yeah, I think Tracy covered that really well. It is really thrilling to be able to talk to so many students. Students are really the leaders and scientists and politicians and business people in the next decade or two, and I think it's really important for them to start looking at some of the really interesting and complex and impossible challenges of the world. So it was really fun to have them in the audience.
Well, that's
yeah, and I'll just add one more to that. This is Tracy, is that since ACM funded this tour that we did, and this was a pretty unique tour that we did. ACM does a lot of distinguished lectures, but I am not aware of any type tour like we did in China that ACM has done. So, of course, all three of us are hoping that our visits will increase ACM membership. Certainly with a membership of ACM come a number of benefits, both for faculty and students.
This is Justine, and we might also be hoping that ACM sends us on the next trip to the next country where they're opening a new ACM office. We feel like we've gotten the drill down a little bit, and we would be great, great people to send along if ACM hears this.
Yeah, and that would be a tremendous honor to do it again with you and Fran, Justine.
Yep.
Well,
we volunteer for that.
Well, it sounds like you also need somebody to do interviews along the way as well, so.
You could come with us, Eva.
Okay, well, you know, we have a really interesting interview being conducted right now, and we're breaking this into two parts. So, again, thank the distinguished scientists for coming in to do this interview today, Dr. Francine Berman, Dr. Justine Cassell, Dr. Tracy Camp, and we'll continue with a part two of this series.
Thanks very much.